These are eggs. Quick whisk, no risk, protein punch, power lunch, bake for dinner, easy winner, fed the lot, hit the spot, eggs. And why pick up more eggs when you're shopping? Because there are more ways to enjoy them. Like bacon and mushroom fried rice with poached eggs, delicious sautéed potatoes with spinach and eggs, or everyone's favourite, a simple cheese omelette for lunch. So versatile, so nourishing. And always choose eggs with a Board Bia quality mark for the highest standards verified at every stage. Eggs, crack on.
This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920, there's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
Seachtain, an Indo Ascaeilge.
Time I mon iarrachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach an seo gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintear féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuir na meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam ag gnám go raibh orthchar an reachtam. Iadach sé tarrin grúvan ar cairstan i lis dúhal agus gimine fnacht gór a clig sár dúchas in éachar. Nau ni vin áun dár dárach sé sin, vin marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Hello and welcome to this special St. Patrick's Day, or Lá Éile Fádraic as we say in Irish, edition of the Indo Daily. March 17th is more than just a regular holiday. It's gone from being St. Patrick's Day to now a week-long St. Patrick's Festival, and its global appeal is greater than ever. But who was St. Patrick, and how has the saint's name travelled across the world, from Nigeria to Times Square and beyond? I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Donal Fallon, author, historian, and host of the Three Castles Burning podcast, whose article on the top 100 Patricks of all time you can read in the Irish Independent. Today, we unveil the most memorable Patricks, Paddies and Patricias to leave a mark on the saint's legacy. Donal, St. Patrick, a real person or a combination of people?
Well, certainly not the founder of a football club in Inchicore, but yeah, a real person of the 5th century. And I think what generally happens in that, when we look at that time in history and sources being the way they are, is that, yeah, people become muddled. And what you get is this kind of amalgamation, if you will. So the St. Patrick we know is a little bit St. Patrick, who gives us his kind of autobiographical sketch of his own life. Fantastic thing to have. And a character called Palladius, who was kind of wandering around Ireland before St. Patrick. So you might joke that, you know, St. Patrick kind of converted an already converted people. You know, it kind of seems like Palladius had been here somewhat before him. But I think these two missionary figures, yeah, in the telling of the tale of early Christian missionaries in Ireland, maybe Palladius is a little bit uncomfortable, if you will, pushed aside, and they've become one. And Brian O'Nolan, better known as Miles Nicopoline, he had a great joke about this. He said, look, we can't agree on this. He said, the Irish are a funny people. They've no God and two St. Patricks. So these 5th century characters, if you will, kind of morphed into one in the telling of the tale.
No, but of course, famously, we kidnapped St. Patrick, dragged him here and forced him into a life of slavery, didn't we?
Against his own will, yeah. Which is an extraordinary part of the tale, that the patron saint of Ireland, if you want to apply modern-day geography to it, is something of a Welshman. But the story of Patrick is marvellous for all kinds of reasons. I mean, what is the walk around the city today? What is the iconography of St. Patrick's Day? It's snakes. You know, we know the climate of Ireland. There are no snakes in Ireland. They're a metaphor for paganism. The idea that Patrick drives paganism from the island of Ireland. If you look at people in New York City or Boston today, they're wearing four-leaf clovers. You know, absolutely wild symbol, doesn't mean anything to do with Ireland. It's the shamrock of three parts, the idea of the Holy Trinity. So there's so much symbolism in the story of St. Patrick and how it's told.
And we've been happy over time to kind of go along with that.
Absolutely.
He banishes snakes. Did he go back home and then hear the voice of the Irish pagans vision, calling him back?
This vision from God urging him to return. And the confession is worth reading. I mean, it's sometimes called I Am Patrick, but its proper historical title, Confessio, or Confession of Patrick. Very easy to access and to read online, and well worth having a look at. But yeah, he returns. Patrick, when he's here against his will, is forced to work as a shepherd. on Mount Slemish in Ulster, and he claims later to have that vision to return and to bring Christianity. But it's not the birthday of Patrick, it's the death day, if you will. Patrick is said to have died on the 17th of March, and hence that becomes, I suppose, St. Patrick's Day.
Now, we didn't have TikTok back in those days. So what actual factual accounts are we relying upon now to tell us about St. Patrick?
Yeah, very few. And I think that is where Palladius comes into play. And 5th century sources are few and far between, the annals and the like. So there isn't a great deal to work off beyond this relatively short confession. And even the legitimacy of that and Patrick's autobiographical sketch has been challenged too. So the afterlife of St. Patrick, in many ways, is clearer than the life, if you will. The way this figure has been used, if you will, and has been centred in making Irish identity is clearer than his life itself. But St. Patrick's Day, as we know it, I mean, it exists on several different planes. And we were talking before we came on, you've been there, you've seen it in Washington, D.C. I've seen it in New York City. It's a very different thing there. It's quite austere, actually, in New York. You know, it's the bishops, it's followed by the firefighters, followed by the police, followed by the military. It's certainly not the kind of Mardi Gras parade that, you know, in Dublin it's kind of taken the form of in recent times. But it's a real 19th century phenomenon, St. Patrick's Day, as we know it.
What about it becoming a bank holiday? When did that happen?
James O'Mara, great political survivor. He was a Home Rule MP in Westminster in the days of Parnell. And he stuck around long enough to become a Sinn Féin TD in the First Dáil. So he was there for a long, long time. 1904, O'Mara introduces the Bank Holiday Act Ireland, which gets St. Patrick's Day as a day off, if you will. But interestingly, he also insists that the public houses are closed. So it's a very sombre, quite religious day in the early 20th century. Patrick's Day is, well, St. Patrick is also the patron saint of Nigeria. So the first three figures on this list are St. Patrick himself, of course, Palladius, Patrick before Patrick, and then I kind of jokingly put in St. Patrick of Lagos. And we have this very interesting history with Nigeria. I mean, think about Nigeria. It's a country that comes out of empire, has its own kind of decolonial story. Sean Lamass actually attended the birth, if you will, of an independent Nigeria in 1960, the only white nation to do that. So Irish Christian missionaries, big part of the story in Nigeria. And Patrick is the patron saint there too, but it's not a bank holiday. So again, Patrick's Day in different parts of the world, we're unique in making it a bank holiday, but it's a day that carries resonance and importance in other places too.
Whether it's Irish identity, whether for religious reasons, St. Patrick does cut across a number of different platforms.
Totally. And I find those Irish Christian missionaries in Africa and Asia really interesting. My father is an unusual name, Lazarian, a saint from the west of Ireland. You don't meet many Lazarians in Ireland. And out of curiosity one day, I think it was on LinkedIn, and I just put in Lazarian. And there were loads of lads in Nigeria with the name. Obviously, a Christian missionary had established a school there, if you will, at some point. And this name from rural Ireland had been passed down. So I find St. Patrick's Day in Africa really, really interesting. And while Ireland doesn't have we do have a colonial history in some ways in the army and the navy of Britain, but we don't have a colonial history as a state. This missionary work in Africa and Asia, that gives us an interesting international story too.
Yeah, our own St. Patrick's who went across the world to spread the faith. The shamrock, again, talk to me about its origins as this symbol of St. Patrick.
The shamrocks and shillelaghs and all of that. And we maybe lump the shamrock in our minds now with, you know, green milkshakes at McDonald's and other things that we see as being a little bit trivial around the day. But actually, the bowl of shamrock in itself has a very interesting political history. I mean, the relationship between Ireland and the United States was incredibly strained after the Second World War. The American ambassador in Dublin during the war, David Gray, had kind of sent back very muddled reports that Ireland was very pro-Axis, and the division that was between Dublin and Washington after the Second World War took a long, long time to heal. And the idea of going to the White House with a bowl of shamrock every year around St. Patrick's Day, that was soft diplomatic power, but it was also intended to build those bridges and to rebuild that relationship with America. And to put it in context, the first year we did it, it wasn't even directly presented to the president. It was just sent to the White House as a gesture. And in time, it grew into this great, great ceremony that it is today.
Good evening, everyone. Mr. President, Ms. Obama, and Taoiseach. There's an old saying that goes like this: if you're lucky enough to be Irish, well, you're lucky enough.
You know this as a writer of political news. I mean, Ireland is the only nation on earth that's a guaranteed audience every year with the President of the United States. So that bowl of shamrock in its own way has become a very powerful thing that's, you know, opened many, many doors.
So did St. Patrick use the shamrock to say, aha, pagan Irelander. If you look at your little tree-leaf vegetation here, and I will explain to you, that is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. This is the Holy Trinity. You are now a Christian. God bless you.
Much more in the telling of the tale afterwards, I think. You have to remember, illiteracy levels would have been very, very high. I think the way of communicating stories like this from folklore, from mythology, and using them in a contemporary, useful way, a way for, you know, priests to tell this story, is to draw so heavily on these metaphors.
Has it become the shamrock? Has it become part of the diddly eye stereotype of Ireland, do you think?
One of the great symbols of Irish diaspora on the world stage is arguably Glasgow Celtic Football Club. And they wear the four-leaf clover and not the shamrock. So at one point, these two symbols were kind of interchangeable, it seems, amongst the Irish diaspora. But yeah, the shamrock very much won out the day.
Yeah, because, I mean, Glasgow Celtic having its own origins from Brother Walfrid.
Of course,
again,
yeah.
You know, heavy Catholic influence. And yet it wasn't the shamrock, it was the four-leaf clover.
Yeah,
was using that, in that case.
And Hibernian Football Club in Edinburgh, the first in green and white, it should be remembered, they went with the harp, that great symbol of Ireland. So these symbols are important things in their own way. And every nation has its own iconography. You know, every nation has its own identity built around these kind of things.
What about, though, where that's kind of turned back against us and the stereotypes are used in a very negative way? Tell us about Punch Paddy, then.
So I was asked to compile this list of 100 Patricks, and it struck me that actually, rather than just writing about 100 individuals, it could be interesting to take 100 characters, if you will, as well. So you have Paddy Irishman, for example, and getting into the origins of that joke and where that comes from. But also this idea of Punch magazine and the Paddy that they put forward in the 19th century, who, you know, is almost like a simian character. He's like this monkey. Often, you know, he's depicted as this dangerous brute. He's maybe clutching a shillelagh. He's sitting on a keg of Fenian dynamite.
The Irish, when they first arrived, were considered the lowest of the low, by most Americans. They were very poor. Most of them were illiterate or even just semi-literate. Most Americans developed, through the things they read in the newspapers and also through political cartoons, a very negative impression of the Irish.
You know, and that idea of this dangerous monkey-like figure, this, you know, Paddy the Terrorist, if you will, and that term terrorism really enters political speak around the Fenian movement. And Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa is called Jeremiah O'Dynamite Rossa in the American press, and he's a dangerous Paddy in the cartoons and illustrations too. So, yeah, something that was quite playful, you know, Paddy with his shillelagh dancing at the crossroads, could be turned into something very politically, I suppose, threatening.
Yeah,
and
Punch Paddy, in effect, you know, politically he represents the quest for Irish independence, and he's represented as this simian-like kind of half leprechaun, half monkey.
Absolutely, yeah. And Punch magazine really shapes the discourse, you know, in the 19th century. You get a lot of kind of supernatural themed cartoons. All that was happening in literature. So you have Frankenstein, you know, you have Parnell is unable to control the Frankenstein creation of the Fenians. Dracula is a big thing as well. So you have, you know, the Fenian vampire. All of that is coming in Punch. But they're using these stereotypical images of Ireland, if you will, to create this negative perception. And unfortunately for Ireland, they were very, very good at it. I suppose it was kind of inevitable that this would happen, but that Irish nationalists and the home rulers, the Parnellites, they eventually learned how to play the game too. So while you had Punch Paddy and you had this very, you know, negative, stereotypical depiction of Irish nationalism, what you get back are these kind of cartoons of a brutish kind of John Bull, if you will, or Aaron, the Maid of Aaron, you know, fighting off the British vampire. So it was a two-way street, but the power of the political cartoon in the 19th century was absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, these newspapers today, the Irish Independent, Sunday Independent, Evening Herald, we still have that. You know, we still have cartoons as a way of communicating within our newspapers. So as much as print media has changed, that's one thing from the 19th century that has still found its page.
What about the use of Paddy as this vehicle for political consciousness and the use of the name? Tell us about the Brian O'Doherty case.
The early 1970s, everything is changing on the island of Ireland, and art is swept up in that. And you get artists who had been quite innocent in terms of what they were making. So I think about Robert Balla. Robert Balla introduces pop art into Ireland, and the work is very funny, it's very playful, and then something just switches in the 70s. It becomes very political art. That happens as well with Brian O'Doherty. A brilliant artist symbolically changes his working name from Brian O'Doherty to Paddy Ireland. You know, he's horrified at the unfolding violence in the north. And he kind of wants to ensure that you can't talk about his work, which is being displayed in London, in New York City, without acknowledging what's happening in the north. So Paddy Ireland is the working name, and he claims he's going to keep that name until British troops leave Ulster. Now, in the end, he kind of symbolically lays the name to rest in recent years. Brian passed only, I think, last year, but he lays the name to rest when he feels the conditions have been met. Post-Good Friday Agreement, the end of Operation Banner, all of that. And anyone who's walking in the grounds of IMA, the Irish Museum of Modern Art, the Royal Hospital Kilmainham, in the Rose Garden, there's a little headstone in the ground. You could easily miss it, but it says, Paddy Ireland is here. And how many people have walked by that symbolic grave without knowing that story? But to take Paddy, you know, the insult of insults tossed at the Irish, and to wear it so defiantly as a political badge, Paddy Ireland, I just think that's a great little tale.
And ultimately, is his posthumous name, is it Brian or is it Paddy?
Brian O'Doherty. Yeah, he felt that you know, in a post-Good Friday Agreement world and with the institutions as they were, that, you know, the time had come that he could lay that name to rest.
Lay it back. What about anti-Irish sentiment? You mentioned the Troubles, which obviously was deeply challenging, not just for the Irish state, but for the Irish emigrant community over in the UK. But it's not the only time where there's been kind of anti-Irish sentiment. Take us back to the post-war period.
Yeah,
well.
I mean, first of all, anti-Irish sentiment and the diaspora. I mean, I think when you live somewhere else and when you have that feeling of being othered or otherness, that can really enforce your sense of Irishness. And often there's no one as Irish as a second generation Irish person living in West Hampstead, Kilburn, New York, wherever it may be. So in the diaspora in Britain, loads of, a surprising amount of people actually have the name Patrick, often as a middle name. Stephen Patrick Morrissey. I mean, of the Smiths, the eight parents of the Smiths, only one of those eight parents was not born on the island of Ireland, which is extraordinary. Declan Patrick McManus, Elvis Costello.
Big Jimmy!
Yeah!
Al!
Yeah!
For God's sake, burn it down.
Then you get Dexy's Midnight Runners, that great track, Burn It Down, which is a real response to anti-Irish ignorance. It's a lovely chorus. It says, they never talk about Oscar Wilde, they never talk about Samuel Beckett, they never talk about Edna O'Brien, all these Irish geniuses.
Ask you once more.
To wear that name as a badge of honour in the diaspora in Britain and America was a real thing. But yeah, anti-Irish prejudice, it exists everywhere, of course, at different times and for different reasons. 19th century New York, it's motivated by all kinds of things, but politics is a big part of it. I mean, the Fenian Brotherhood, the secret revolutionary underground organisation born on St. Patrick's Day, 1858, it's really viewed as the enemy within, if you will. J. Edgar Hoover later talks about, you know, Irish Fenianism as one of the great internal threats to America. So the Irish are viewed as, not only are they from somewhere else, they're politically suspect. And that's part of this tale as well.
Is there an actual issue about Irish migrants who are very often from the peasant classes moving abroad? They're uneducated, they're working their way up in manual labour. Is there an issue that they get a reputation as the drunken paddies?
In some places, yeah, absolutely. And this idea that there's a never-ending flow of them, that's present in 19th century cartoons as well. You know, like Paddy is just multiplying and never-ending. One of the names on the list is Wimpy. Wimpy was a construction firm in England, but the joke about the name Wimpy, which was commonly heard in London, was that Wimpy stood for "We import more paddies every year." So this idea that the paddy was multiplying, if you will, that the stream of paddies into New York or into London or into Manchester just couldn't be controlled.
We have that debate here at the moment about our own burgeoning population, immigration to this country, and the fact that our population has hit 5 million for the first time since famine times, when a million people died and a million people emigrated. So there was that constant stream, as you say, particularly 1840s onwards, for a good 50, 70 year period.
Paddy Hazelton is on the list, was born in Uganda.
Okay.
Which is interesting. He's a Bowron player born in Uganda. So there's a little bit of it in the migrant community. Patrick is a name. And that's not uncommon too, you know, that when you have arrived somewhere and you're assimilating, if you will, or you're trying to assimilate into a culture, that you adopt these things. Back in the 1890s in Dublin, I found a Jewish family, and they named their children Robert Emmett Briscoe and Theobald Wolf Tom Briscoe. You think about it, that's around the backdrop of the 1798 centenary. You're trying to, I suppose, fit in, if you will, to a society and its idea of itself.
What about emigrants who excel in their own right? And in this regard, you don't turn to a name like Ford or Fitzgerald or Biden, for example.
Yeah.
Tell us about Babe MacDonald.
I love this story. Patrick Joseph MacDonald is actually Patrick Joseph MacDonald. But when he arrives in Ellis Island, Clare immigrant family, it's taken down wrong. And that's not uncommon, actually. Often people are trying to find what happens to their relatives when they make it to the United States and they lose them at Ellis Island. And it could be that they had an Irish language name that was, you know, mistranslated. It could be that they themselves decided to abandon the family name and go with something easier. Or it could be that whatever, you know, Italian bureaucrat was working on the desk that day just took it down wrong. So the MacDonalds from Clare, ELLS become MacDonalds. And he's an amazing story. Typical New York story in some ways. Traffic policeman in Times Square. Enormous guy. I mean, one New York newspaper talks about him as a living Statue of Liberty standing in the middle of Times Square, but really excels as a hammer thrower. A real 19th century sporting phenomenon was hammer throwing in the Olympic Games. And he's on the top of the world stage. So he's a New York police officer. He's a competing Olympian. He's a presence in Times Square. He's the embodiment, if you will, of the Irish migrant in New York City.
Is he a typical example of Irish migrants, okay, went out and these are the hands that built America and so on, but also got involved in the public service, the police, the fire department, in medicine and in hospitals, but also in politics.
Yeah.
The Irish really made a big impact.
Absolutely, extraordinary. In New York City especially and in those frontline services. The fire department, my father's a retired firefighter. I mean, the fire department of New York, the Emerald Society, it's just dripping in the identity of all of that. The NYPD is the same. So, yeah, I mean, the idea that they go right in at that level of public service, be it the army. And by the way, sometimes they can turn their backs on that army. I mean, one group of lads who are on the list, there's a section called the Collective Paddies. And you have, for example, the St. Patrick's Rowing Club, St. Patrick's Athletic, but the Battalion de San Patricio. The St. Patrick's Battalion, Irishmen who join the American Armed Forces, they're sent to Mexico, the American-Mexican War is on, and they feel this, I suppose, internal contradiction in what they're doing, and instead they fight on the side of the Mexicans, which is an incredible story. So they abandon the uniform that they're paid to wear, and they fight on the other side.
What about one final paddy? And we have to point out here, this is not a male paddy, this is actually a female paddy. Tell us about, who is Etna Padgreen Ní Vreanáin?
Sounds great there, doesn't it? Yeah, from Guidobar, from Irish-speaking Guidobar. And that is Enya. That's not a name people may know. And yeah, you really have achieved a certain level of fame when you're, you know, you're known in that way. Be you Enya, be you Bono, in politics, be you Bertie or Mary Lou, if you're known just by that. But Enya's on the list. And when I was approached about doing this piece, they said, make sure you put some Patricias on the list, you know, in the interest of balance. I'm not entirely convinced Patricia Patrick is the same name, you know, by
origin. Is it the female derivation of Patrick?
That's debated and that's challenged. But Porrigeen, you know, when we think about names in Ireland, of a babeen, a small baby, a putchie, the small pot, een. That's the female equivalent of Patrick, the closest thing to it is Porrigeen. So we find it here with Enya. But I find her a fascinating figure for all kinds of reasons. I mean, how can someone be so internationally famous? Second only to U2 in terms of sales as an Irish musical export. And then relatively unknown in other ways too, you know. Someone who's very, very private. And I was struck by these words from her. I could have been more famous if I did all the glitzy things, but celebrity always seems so unnecessary. Fame and success are very different things. And that really sums up Enya, doesn't it?
Are you of the view that maybe if Patricia isn't the direct derivation of Patrick, that the reason why so many Irish women were named Patricia and Padraigín over the years is because of
Patrick?
I think
so, absolutely. And that gives it its own importance in Ireland too. But these names, I mean, traditionally Irish names are slipping down the charts every year. It's interesting to see what names are becoming more popular in Ireland and what names are fading a little bit. And sometimes even a name that we might associate with more traditional times and older times, it can have a little bit of a resurgence. So Bridget, for example, and the way St. Bridget's Day has become something very different as well. And a little bit like St. Patrick's Day, actually, St. Bridget is this
mythical figure.
Figures that have become one in the telling of the tale today. And you can kind of have St. Bridget in whatever variety you want. But Bridget's Day has become quite a trendy thing in its own way. And the Bridget's Cross has reemerged as a very strong symbol. So the name Bridget is rising in Ireland. Patrick as a name is actually surprisingly popular amongst migrant communities, as we mentioned, especially within the Nigerian community, but slipping amongst the Irish. So That's interesting in its own way too, isn't it? There was a time when I think one in five boys born in Ireland were given a variation of the name Patrick.
For St. Patrick, banishing the snakes, I'll see you and raise you. St. Bridget putting her cloak down and it covering the Curragh of Kildare and her being granted that land as a result from it by a feudal king. What about this? We've just gone through a couple of famous Patricks and Patricias and Padraigines. Babe MacDonald, Enya, are they emblematic of Ireland becoming prominent on the global stage?
Yeah.
And it's associated with the name Patrick.
Yeah, I really, I mean, I really enjoyed digging into this list because what I didn't expect to be so ever present in it was the Irish on the world stage. You know, I thought you would have a list of, you know, Patrick Hillary instantly came to mind, former president, Patrick Kavanagh came to mind. But actually, it's a very global history of Ireland. And I wasn't entirely sure at the outset that that was how it would turn out. But yeah, I mean, we can learn a lot about not just Ireland, but Ireland's, for a very, very small nation, our cultural contribution to the world and our political place in the world is extraordinary and well worth celebrating.
And my thanks to Donal Fallon for joining me today. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's special episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Dave Hanratty and Garrett Mulhall, researched by JJ Clark and Tabitha Monaghan, with sound by John Smith. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to follow and leave us a review.
These are eggs. Quick whisk, no risk, protein punch, power lunch, bake for dinner, easy winner, fed the lot, hit the spot eggs. And why pick up more eggs when you're shopping? Because there are more ways to enjoy them, like bacon and mushroom fried rice with poached eggs, delicious sautéed potatoes with spinach and eggs, or everyone's favourite, a simple cheese omelette for lunch. So versatile, so nourishing. And always choose eggs with the Board Bia quality mark for the highest standards verified at every stage. Eggs. Crack on.